Hey, welcome to Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party. Here with Jeff Vargin, and we're talking about questions that you might have about the programs that we're doing.
Yeah, Mark, I'm here behind the camera, and congratulations on your tours, recent tours. And we've had lots of questions come in from our fans out there, and they're submitting them by email. Our email, you'll see, is right on the screen right now. We're happy to answer any questions we can. First question comes about bands. The person says, you front many different bands and groups, the Blues Survivors, the Basement Shakers, Little Walter and James Cotton tribute shows, the Flashbacks, the Golden State Lone Star Review, and the Harmonica Blowout Tour Band. How do you decide which band will play on which tour or gig?
That's a good question. The Deep Basement thing, I've kind of let that go, to tell you the truth. But all the rest of them, a lot of it just kind of depends on the event that we're doing. It depends on the tour that I'm doing, who I've had out recently, who I haven't had out in a while. This year, I'm primarily working with Anson Funderburg. And it was more, the reasoning was that Junior Watson, who was booked on a lot of this stuff, became more and more unavailable with just personal things going on. And so Anson is pretty much doing the entire year.
Here's another question that sort of follows up on that kind of idea. It says, the person says, I've always wondered how musicians put tours together. How do you begin to plan a tour? What's a kind of a chicken or the egg thing?
Okay, that's a good question. A lot of times when I tour, you need an anchor date to start. And an anchor date is like a festival that's paying more money to basically bankroll the tour. So you have to have that in advance. There's times that I've just started tours just because, you know, I got maybe this number of dates, like say like a 4-date rundown in Southern California like I'm doing. That kind of was the predecessor to booking the rest of the dates in the South, you know, Southwest and Southeast.
So that would be like, because you're already in Southern California,
yeah.
You might as well continue
Let's just continue on. And I mean, you know, the other thing is nowadays, a lot of times I'll kind of book a tour according to, well, I got to put some miles on the van to write off miles at the end of the year. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that come into it. But primarily what I've done over the, like, say, the last year and a half, I mean, if I look back on it, I've done tours with, say, Junior Watson. You know, then I might do a tour with somebody like Anson Funderburg. Then I might do a James Cotton tribute tour. And I'm kind of going according to what I'm thinking that people want in terms of festivals and that sort of thing.
This dovetails to this other question. I sort of categorize these questions into, you know, when I got them in, I put them into categories. And this is more on the tours. How do you plan which cities you will play and what venues? And you said a little bit about anchoring with a city, but when you're just going to decide, I want to go on a tour, how do you know what cities and venues? Are they from things you've done before?
Well, yeah, most of it is. I mean, considering I've got 39 years of touring in me that I've done, I kind of know where a lot of the hot spots are that I have more popularity. So a lot of times I follow things according to, you know, where I've been before that we have a good following. You know, the other thing is I kind of like to try to return to a lot of areas that I did, say, the year before. And so, like, I mean, this next tour, I hadn't been in the Southwest for a long time. It'd been a really long time. So I'd done Los Angeles, but I really hadn't done things in, say, Arizona, or, you know, it'd been at least 4 or 5 years since I'd done Texas, you know, things like that. So, you know, Oklahoma, I haven't done Oklahoma for years. So a lot of times I just kind of go according to where I haven't been for a while, but also places I want to return to kind of keep the following intact.
And to follow up on that, and some of it with the band thing, a question is, do you always travel with a full band, or do you pick up local musicians along the way at times?
The majority of the time I travel with my full band. There have been times like last year we did do, me and Anson did a tour where we used like three local guys. Actually, the tour's coming up. I'm using a piano player that lives in the South, and he's driving up on his own to join us. So, I mean, I know musicians all over. So a lot of times the way I'll decide is the economics of the tour. So in other words, if I have to fly less people, then that's more money for, say, me and Anson than if, you know, I have to fly everybody.
Right.
You know.
Again, following up on that, it seems like you have played and toured with a lot of the same musicians over the years.
Yeah.
Do you ever bring in new or younger musicians? And second part is, what does it take to be part of Mark Hummel's Blues Survivors? If I'm a young guitar player out there and I want to audition
that's a good question. I mean, for example, last year I did do a thing with somebody I'd never worked with before down south. I think it was a year ago in March that I went down and I played with a guy named Skylar Softly. And I had a bass player named Josh Minucci, who's a really good upright player down in Florida. I had Clay Swofford, the piano player I was talking about earlier. He was playing piano, and it really kind of came together through Clay, because Clay said something like, you know, hey, if you ever want to do gigs down here, I know some guys that could back you up. And the South is notorious for not paying well. The South generally is one of the hardest markets to really get any kind of money out of and to route. It's also a very, very hard area to route because you're looking for weekdays and the money on the weekdays doesn't pay well. So in that situation, I did get like these guys together for a 3-week tour and were able to work Florida dates, deep South dates in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia. I can't remember if we did any Louisiana dates, but we definitely did, you know, that neck of the woods. So in a situation like that, it worked out great because, you know, everybody was really, you know, a great player. And I did a little bit of rehearsing and it worked out fine. So it really just depends on where I'm going, you know, the time of the year. There's just a lot of things that come into it.
There's been a lot of stories over years of musicians being in a club and somebody walks up and meets them and they get invited on stage. Have you ever met any local musicians?
That happens all the time.
Hey, this guy is
incredible. Happens all the time. And to be honest with you, it seems to be sort of a wave of the future that a lot of musicians are starting to travel less and less with bands from where they live because it's such a long way from California all the way out to the East Coast. That's, you know, you're talking 3,000 miles, and it's much easier to take a flight than drive a van out 3,000 miles. And I've done so much van work that, to be honest with you, doing cross-country is not something that I'm really that keen on doing anymore, the cross-country drives. So we are doing it this time, but, you know, like the three tours after that or not. You know, we're flying in. We're renting a van or borrowing a van, renting equipment, borrowing equipment. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of different things that come into it. I love working with certain musicians that I've been working with for years. I mean, somebody like Wes Starr, we go back, you know, 14 years now of working together. Or Anson goes back 12 years. You know, somebody like Randy Bermudez on bass or Kedar Roy, those are guys I've known for years as well. June Corr on drums. You know, we all go way back. There's, you know, Bob Welsh. All these guys go back, you know, 20-something years each or longer.
And are these guys your first call?
They're kind of my first call guys, yeah.
Yeah,
because they're so good and they're so, you know, they're so aware of my repertoire. But, you know, I mean, the flip side is these are very popular musicians and they play with a lot of really popular names. You know, people like Charlie Musselwhite or Elvin Bishop or the Fabulous Thunderbirds. I mean, you know, that's going to be a lot of times their first call gigs because they pay well.
Right.
Mine pay okay, but they don't quite pay with those guys. have to offer.
There's even a question down the line about that a little bit, but here's one of, how has touring and the business of touring changed since you first started?
Yeah, it's a dramatic difference, touring. When I first started touring, I started touring in 1984. And when I toured, you could literally have a cassette tape and send it to a nightclub and they would hire you. So those days are long gone. Now you have to have, you know, Pollstar reports of what your numbers are. You have to have publicity. You have to have a record company. You have to have, you know, a presence on YouTube. There's so many things that are necessary now to really tour. And so, you know, I'd say the biggest thing is that you know, nowadays you have to have what they call a presence media-wise. And so I've had a publicist for, you know, over probably 18 years now that works a lot of my stuff. I've had a record company now for over 20 years that I've worked with. You know, I've got, people know that they're going to get a certain quality band when I come in town. And I have established that. And there's no venue owner that you can talk to that could say, well, Mark Hummel really brought in a stinker this last time.
Right.
That just doesn't happen.
And that might dovetail into why you tend to work with these same guys.
Yeah,
you know
absolutely.
What you're going to get every
absolutely.
Night. Absolutely. That translates into your show being better and the promoter is happier.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It's like a risk aversion thing. You can't really afford to take somebody you didn't
know. No, I can't really take somebody that I don't know anything about or can't attest to what kind of talent they have. I mean, I'm not saying I haven't worked with guys. I mean, over the last few years, I've worked with some, especially on the East Coast, I've worked with some musicians and upright bass player Mike Law did a tour with me and Rusty Zinbeck in 2022. You know, him and a drummer, Nick Toscano, who played on this tour last summer. They were both excellent. They're excellent musicians. They tour with a lot of people back east. This time we're taking out an East Coast bass player in April, Ted Bukowski, who played on the tour that me and Anson did last summer on the East Coast dates. So, you know, I mean, a lot of times if I know somebody is really a solid player, I have no problem taking them out. It's just I have to kind of bear in mind, like, for example, I'm doing a new album release coming up, and that's going to be out in, say, June, and I want to have guys that were, like, on the album is my, you know, one of the things I'd like to concentrate on.
There's some questions about recording coming up. Well, now, what about blues audiences? How have audiences changed?
Well, unfortunately, the audiences haven't gotten younger. It's kind of the same audience that I started with, and I'm not saying it's unfortunate. I feel very fortunate to have people that come and see me after all these years. That's a wonderful thing, but I haven't seen it get passed down to a younger audience. And the sad part is I see that even to the extent of that a lot of the younger blues musicians that are around, they're still getting my audience.
Oh.
And that's kind of like, that's kind of a strange thing that they haven't attracted a younger audience. So, I mean, I see all kinds of younger musicians like Skylar Softley or Clay Swofford, those guys, you know, they're playing to the same people I play for.
So do you think
it's people at least 20, 30 years older.
So this generation, and I'm that generation, as we fade off into the sunset, and I don't mean die, I mean just get to the point where we don't go out on clubs anymore.
Right.
What are these young people going to do?
Well, that's what's kind of
going to die?
That's what's kind of a scary thing, is that you want people to come along that are going to support the music. And you have musicians that have come along, and they support it to a certain degree, but a general mass audience has not been the case.
Right.
And maybe there's people that I don't know about, like maybe Joe Bonamassa has a young audience, maybe Nick Moss has a younger audience. I'm not sure, but I just know for the younger musicians that I've seen play, I haven't seen that many young people coming to our shows.
So the level, maybe the theater and the outdoor venues, those acts are doing okay, but the club acts are going to struggle, do you think?
Well, I think club acts in general struggle because, you know, you're talking about having to work 7 nights a week. And it's a lot harder to get somebody in their 60s or 70s out to a gig, you know, in on a Wednesday or Tuesday night than it is a young person. Because young people have less obligations. They're not as, you know, they're not as beat when they get home from work or whatever. So, you know, I mean, I know when I was young, I went out every night of the week. And now that I'm older, I don't. So,
you know, I just saw recently where young people now are changing the demographic because they're all going to bed at 9 o'clock.
Right.
They would rather get up early and have this day.
Right.
Our generation was,
we were late nighters.
Leave the house right until 9 o'clock.
That's right.
So is that changing clubs?
Well, what I've noticed in clubs, yes, is there's a 6 and 7 o'clock start time that's becoming more and more normal.
Not like the 9 and 10 o'clock.
Right. No, I mean, almost nobody's doing that.
Okay.
Very few venues are doing a 9 or 10 o'clock start anymore.
Wow.
And that was the norm. When I started, man, that was the norm.
Oh, back in the day when I went to the Keystone and Berkeley, the opening act, the main, it was about till midnight.
Right.
Yeah.
That was the norm. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, things have really changed, you know, over the, you know, 40-something years I've been doing this.
You mentioned a little bit about YouTube. What's social media's impact been on blues and touring?
I think social media has been huge in terms of keeping blues visible. I mean, if you go to YouTube, you can find almost anything on YouTube what relates to blues. There's occasional ones that are hard to find, but for the most part, I mean, I have some very rare recordings, and I was actually able to find them on YouTube, you know, a couple of years after I got them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's saying something.
Now to a little bit more of the players and the business side of touring. If I'm a young musician and I don't have any touring experience, but I'm fantastic and Mark Hummel hires me to come on a tour, do I get paid per gig, per week, per tour? How do I, as a freelance musician, be able to make my living?
I don't know how you're going to make your living touring these days.
Are you paying me per gig, per week?
Usually what I do is I come up with a budget because I have to put all the expenses I have to outline first. What's it going to take if I have to rent a van? What's it going to take to fly? What's it going to take if I have to rent equipment? What's it going to take to rent hotel rooms? The price of gas. You know, I have to put all these things in the hopper. And then after I've done that and figured out what that's going to cost, then I can figure out what I'm paying people. But it really varies. I mean, you know, my rule of thumb is that I want to pay people anything from, you know, a bill 50 to, you know, to 500 a night or whatever, you know, depending on who it is you're talking about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, bigger names, you know, hopefully 1,000 a night. But it just varies, you know. And generally what I usually come up with is when I'm paying somebody for an entire tour, you're talking about a lot more of a substantial chunk of money than if it was just a few dates. Because
right.
If you're talking 20, 30 dates, that, you know, that generates some income, and it's a lot more than you're going to make at home.
Mm-hmm. If I'm a musician, are musicians calling you looking for work, or are they waiting for a phone call to go on a tour? Is anybody sitting around going, hey, Mark, you going to go on a tour? Do you need somebody? I mean, as a band leader,
people do that. People do get a hold of me and say, if you ever need, you know, a bass player, you ever need a drummer, you know, give me a call. I mean, people always say that. And I mean, I've always got a pretty good backlog of people I can call when I need to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something I've always kept, people's phone numbers. If somebody, you know, that I like, you know, who's playing I like, I will hang on to their phone number. And if it comes down to it, I'll call them.
Do you ever, when you're on a long tour, do you have to have backup plan? Do you know musicians in that area just in case?
Generally, I do.
Sick?
Yeah, generally I do. I remember one time, I think it was one of R.W. Grigsby's relatives died, and he had to step out, and I got a friend of mine that lives in, you know, Pennsylvania to step in and do the gig.
So it happens.
Yeah, it does happen. I mean, I remember years ago, I was playing with Sue Foley's band, and her bass player, who's still with her, John Penner, his brother was killed in an accident, and we had to do the gigs without a bass player for a couple nights. Wow. And because we had two guitars and a drummer, we could, because we all knew how to play that style. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you gotta kind of have backup plans when it comes right down to it. I mean, that was one reason I learned to play some guitar, you know. If it came down to it and I lost a whole band, I could do some solo numbers. I mean, you know, those are the kind of things you want to be able to do just in case.
And when you've gone to Europe, sometimes you've gone to Europe by yourself.
Occasionally.
And do you know who you're going to play with when you get there, or is it all going to be a surprise?
No, I always make sure I know who I'm going to play with. Mm-hmm. And I was in the UK a year ago, and I used English musicians there. And I had people that were already, you know, known to me through some of my friends over there. For example, my friend Steve Weston, who's a harp player, you know, told me, hey, I've got a great drummer and a great bass player that I play with. You ought to think about using them. And then somebody else told me about a guitar player, this guy Lewis Fielding. And, you know, they turned me on to him. So, you know, like a promoter was trying to put together people for me, and I just said, no, right. I want to pick my musicians.
People you trust.
Yes.
Their recommendation.
Yeah, I wanted to trust, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah.
Because you never know what you're going to come up with. I used to do tours a long time ago with, like, some Italian musicians, and I'd end up in kind of hot water sometimes. Mm. This was years ago.
Hot water musically?
Yeah, musically, just not up to par.
Right.
Yeah.
And that reflects on you.
And it does. It definitely reflects on me. I remember one time going to Hong Kong. I did a gig in Hong Kong one time, and I ended up playing with this band. It was this real mishmash of players. And it was like, you know, I tried to pick the simplest songs I could. And the guy from the newspaper came down the first night and reviewed it. And he goes, I guess Hummel didn't realize he didn't have his own blues survivors with him or something like that. Because, you know, I didn't think I was very visibly upset, but it must have come across that some of the people weren't really following.
Just your body language.
My body language was,
Yeah, you can, you know, you're not Van Morrison. You're not just going to turn your back on.
I'm not going to turn my back and scream at him. No.
Scream at him.
No.
Any recent stories where things have just gone horribly bad on the road?
Oh, I've had plenty, and they're all in my book.
Oh, okay, and your book, we'll put your book up on screen.
Yeah. Okay. No, my book, Big Road Blues, 12 Bars on I-80, that's filled with, you know, 36 years of crazy stuff happening. And I mean, crazy stuff's going to happen on the road. That's one thing I thought about fairly recently. I was thinking to myself, you know, because, I mean, I'm in a position where now sometimes I drive out, and I used to have my buddy R.W. driving back with me, and now I got to find somebody that's going to drive back with me. If in the middle of the country some of the guys fly home, mm-hmm. you got to have somebody there that's going to help you drive mm-hmm. all the way the 1,500 miles back home.
Right, and that's a long 1,500.
And that's a long way, man. That's a long thing to do all by yourself or even with one other person. Mm-hmm. And me and R.W. got real used to doing that. But we ended up in some kind of hairy situations. I remember one time we had to sleep in the van because we couldn't find a hotel room for, like, you know, 800 miles.
Yeah, wow.
And we tried every single hotel, and there was some huge, like, you know, construction convention that came into Montana that year or Wyoming that year or that month. And it was like there was all this building going on, so all these construction workers were taking up the hotels.
Huh.
Yeah, so we ended up literally sleeping for like 3 or 4 hours outside of a Flying J, you know, in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Stuff happens, man. Yeah. You really don't know what you're going to get into. Or breakdowns, that's another one. You know, you can have a breakdown anywhere. end up in a little town and not be able to find a good mechanic. So there's a lot of hairy stuff that can come your way.
Well, I was thinking about that as I was looking at your lineup for your tour coming up in the Southwest and the South.
Yeah.
You are night after night after night with what seems like
all
some
one-nighters.
Serious miles in between.
All one-nighters.
And it's just a leap of faith that there's going to be no built-in... Like,
that your van's going to make it.
That your van's going to make it.
That's right, because
that
I mean...
somebody's going to not... they're going to disappear on you or something.
Right. Well, I've had crazy stuff like that happen. Another thing I remember one time with Sue Foley was the drummer disappearing. You know, he just jumped out of the van after a gig and just disappeared. And we didn't know if he was going to show up the next night. And I started calling up, like you're saying, calling up people I knew in Memphis that might be able to do the gig if he didn't show. Mm. And fortunately, he showed up. But I'm just saying, you don't know.
Right.
You never know.
Right.
And so there is a lot of leaps of faith when it comes to going out on the road.
Yeah. Looking at this last tour, I'm like, I don't know how you can get from here to there.
Yeah.
And then I think there's one gig, you're doing like two shows in a day.
We're doing two shows in a day.
And then you are traveling seemingly hundreds and hundreds of miles.
Yeah, well, we're traveling probably 500 miles the next day.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. And that's exhausting all in itself.
It is. And it's like, I mean, you know, I'm 68 years old. And it was like, you know, in 2016, I had a heart attack not long after a tour like that where me and RW had driven 1,500 miles, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd say 10 days later, I had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, it's exhausting. It really is. I mean, being behind the wheel for 3 or 4 weeks at a time is exhausting. It's not an easy thing to do. And, you know, I have to say, I mean, you know, things get easier the longer you do it in the sense of that you become more prepared for what's out there. And, you know, so when we had like a transmission go out before the first date in Portland, we're in Portland, Oregon, we drive into town and literally the transmission took a dump right on the highway. And I had to get towed to our hotel. I had to find somehow a transmission shop to put a new transmission in and try doing that.
Right.
You know, when you got a week before you have to come back, try putting in a new transmission, finding a place that will do it, because almost all of them will say, no, we're three weeks out.
Mm-hmm.
And lucky for me, I found somebody that would do it, and I rented a van. We started the rest of the tour in the rental van. We did a week out on the road with the rental van, came back, the van was ready, and we drove it home.
Right. But it messes up your entire business model, right?
Well, yes, it does. It does. So, I mean, you know, something like my expense of a new engine in this van, I just look at it like, well, that came out of my last tour,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's a tax write-off. So, you know, I mean, you just have to kind of look at it like that. I mean, fortunately, I've done well enough that I've got reserve. I don't have like some kind of bank account with nothing in it. I mean, if I was like that, it would really be hairy. And I read this book by William Clark where, you know, or not by William Clark, about William Clark, where the guy talked about, and I remember playing with a lot of his musicians, William Clark's old musicians, and I would play with them, and they'd tell me these horror stories about him going out on ball tires on tours, and, you know, sometimes like a radiator that wasn't working properly, and you're just asking for trouble mm-hmm. when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a deal with myself that I was never going to go out with a vehicle that was not in good running condition.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not worth it.
No, you have,
there's too many variables getting from gig to gig.
Right.
So those are things I learned early on. I mean, you know, and I think about how many vans I've been through. I've been probably through 10 or 12 vans.
Wow.
You know.
So if you were starting out in blues today, what do you think would be your path? How would you get to
a real job?
A real job?
No, I can't really say that. I mean, you know, when I started doing this, I had a very ambitious kind of drive to get somewhere in the blues business and get somewhere with Blues Harmonica. And fortunately for me, I kind of prepared myself for the pitfalls that it was going to have. So I lived very economically, you know. I mean, I was on food stamps, you know, at the beginning, and I ate a lot of rice and beans, and I just, you know, I really kind of lived very frugally. I lived in this one little basement apartment in Berkeley, and my rent was like $90, and then it went up to $120, and there was rent control back in those days, so I could kind of get away with stuff. But yeah, I mean, I never dreamed of the big time, because I figured in blues, it really wasn't a realistic thing to dream about. And I was right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the blues is a very tiny little percentage of the music business.
Right.
And it's very unpopular compared to, you know, commercial music like pop or rock or you know, classic, you know, ballads, things like that. I mean, blues is just, it's really kind of a thing. It grabs you or it doesn't grab you. And for me, I like the fact that a lot of the singers had rough voices, or that a lot of the guitar players played less notes, or the harmonica players played less notes. I like the economy of the blues. That was really what attracted me to the music, and that it was real. That was huge. Because it's one of the few music out there that really has a sincerity to it. You can't BS your way through it, you know. I mean, you had people in the day like, you know, Little Richard, and then you had Pat Boone, you know. Good golly, Miss Molly, sure like to ball. You know, you had that. But to me, if someone heard the real guy like Little Richard, they'd stop listening to him altogether.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's how I was about blues. I mean, once I heard the real blues guys after listening to, you know, Cream and Blue Cheer and bands like that, I just kind of went, later with that, I'm into these guys. And they weren't near as popular. They did not have that the appeal with white kids that say somebody that looked like them had.
So, getting into that a little bit, it young African Americans do not seem to be moving into the blues.
That's not true at all. No, young African Americans are moving into the blues.
Good.
And it's becoming much more of a thing now because for a long time, I think black people kind of didn't claim the blues almost. Like they kind of really felt like it was old people's music. It was kind of like us listening to Frank Sinatra. That's kind of what it was. And so now there's this new generation of young African American kids that are starting to listen to it. And young adults, and so they're, and what's really cool is that a lot of them are very into this old traditional sound that I love. So there's this one kid, Harold Davenport, he calls himself Young Rel, 17 years old, he just turned 17, he's phenomenal. And it was like when I started talking to him, I was like, this reminds me of me when I was young, you know? And it's a really exciting thing when you meet people that are younger that are into the music like that. It's thrilling. It really is a thrilling thing. So I'm trying to really support. You know, I had Andrew Ali, who's a young African American guy from Richmond, Virginia, and I had him on the Blowouts this year, and that was. I want to try to have at least one young kid, you know, that's into this kind of music, you know. And there's a number of them. There's Jontavious Willis, and he calls himself Quan Willis. There's Marquise Knox. There's Andrew. There's there's a new kid, Mac McDonald, that's a phenomenal young guitar player. J.K. Harrell is another one. So there's really this kind of new crop of players that's starting to come up, and it's a really exciting thing for guys like me and a lot of the, you know, white guys of my generation that have kind of felt like this was like going by the wayside.
Well, this has been quite an education, Mark, and I'm sure our viewers got their questions answered sufficiently, so I want to thank you for doing that.
And don't be disgruntled if, you know, you don't hear back from me.
Right, yeah. He's on tour, and I'm manning sometimes the emails, and it's not always easy to get back. So this was a great opportunity to answer some of these questions and to sort of even some of my own curiosities. As I'm sitting here editing Harmonica Party episodes, all these things come to mind. And
I was thinking about it the other day when I thought about this tour, and I thought, you know, boy, I'm really getting out there doing a tour like this where you got your nose to the grindstone every night.